the name of the program is The Poet and the Poem. I am Grace Cavalieri, and my guest has come all the way from New Jersey to be with us. His name is Joe Salerno, and you're going to like what you hear. Here's Joe.
A sip of blue. I stare down at the blank page before me on the desk, and choosing a single word, I take a sip slowly. Blue. It is like the taste of 100 blue mountains, blue as an angel, a leaf, like the sweet blue taste of a woman's tongue gliding along my teeth. In that one sip, I can even taste the frail spiritual despair of the evening light. And when I put down my pen, the page still empty, I sink into myself like a boy gazing out over the flashing blue shield of a lake, the sunlit water slapping against his wet shoes.
The voice of Joe Salerno. Heard him read in North Jersey a couple of years ago and would not and could not forget it. Then I was lucky enough to get some of the poems in print. He was born in the Bronx, grew up in New Jersey, went to Farley Dickinson in Teaneck, then on to the University of Michigan, where he received his PhD in American literature, and said after that he could not find a job teaching, so eventually became an adjunct professor, and now is a big-time technical writer, whether he likes it or not, very successful in the field, using the other side of the brain. But I want to say, and I want to go on the record as saying, this is one of the most under-recognized great poets of our time, underserved and under-acknowledged, because there is such a highly developed spirit married with language, so graceful, so unpretentious. It is unforgettable stuff. And I told you, if I had a lot of money, honey, I'd publish you.
Well, thanks. But, you know, there's a lot of unrecognized and underserved people out there writing poetry. I think most poets are probably underrecognized and underserved, as you say.
But as I read these poems aloud to different people, I'd say, listen to this line. That's not something you get all the time. That's one of the bennies for my job. So show us your stuff, Joe. This is Joe Salerno, the program's The Poet and the Poem. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we are very happy to present Joe to you tonight.
Okay, well, the second poem is called Only Here. It's the title poem of my manuscript. And just to kind of set the scene, I went from being an adjunct professor with a lot of time on my hands and not too much responsibility to being a father of three children and trying to find a job and work at a regular job. So I had a lot. It was a time in my life when I was hit with a lot of what we might call necessities.
Being grown up,
dealing with necessities that were not very poetic. And it was difficult for me to try to integrate the real world, as I guess my father would call it. But anyway, this poem was written, this was a kind of a breakthrough poem for me in terms of coming to terms with my life at that particular time. So it's called Only Here. I wake holding the blue piece of a dream, and lying still on the cloudy pillow before the day's first word spreads meaning out over the world, I let the morning rain be all I am. And in the slender stone-colored light, the ordinary promises of my life are made again, attaching themselves silkenly like rain to a window, or my car glazed like a white rose in the driveway. And the dream, now cold, blows away like history, my wife stirring beside me, the feathery touch of our third child turning in her widening belly. Downstairs, the kitchen waits. There is nothing to decide. Everything asleep is about to awake, the day set like a mighty clock in the silence. Opening our eyes, we lift the world, the universe tossed like rain from the tips of our lashes. Only here our ordinary eyes learn to find eternity. There is nothing else. The luster is this plainness we walk in, this poverty we rise to at the end of dreaming, the sacrament each day of our feet touching the floor. So what I was trying to deal with there was, you know, just the blessedness of necessity, I guess, and seeing necessity as a sacrament rather than as a sacrifice.
Joe, I cannot imagine how many hundreds of hours are in that poem, but there is not a syllable that jars. It is, and all of your work is this way. It is either that your spirit comes out all of a piece, or else you put a hell of a lot of time in.
Well, it's interesting because this particular poem was, there was only one time in my life when my writing kind of dwindled. And it was around the time my first two children were born. And I, as I said, I was going through all this adjustment. And when I wrote this, this was the first poem I had written after about 2 years of really not writing anything. So there was a lot of emotional investment and a lot of what I had been experiencing for the previous, you know, 2 or 3 years that I was finally able to come to terms with in my own personal life and also in terms of my own, you know,
so the
poetry.
Unity found itself in the poem.
Yeah.
How is being a better poet the same as, or how does it help to be a better father? I think there's a connection.
Well, to me, poetry has always been, I think poetry is about being present to what is in front of you, to what's in front of your eyes, to what you're experiencing at the moment. And if you look at the times when you're being a parent and you're not enjoying it, it's because you're not willing to be present to exactly what's happening at that moment. And this was something I learned a bit from reading Zen philosophy and Zen poetry. It's also something I learned very palpably in 1979 when I did the S training, Werner Erhard's S training, which I know has traditionally gotten a lot of negative press or at least somewhat flippant response, but I thought it was a very powerful and moving experience.
Did it affect your poetry?
Well, this poem was written shortly after I had finished the training.
You do have a poem which describes what eternity is. Do you have that one with you?
The last lines,
isn't it, to the effect, being really here is what eternity is. I'm paraphrasing.
Ah, yes, I know which
that's
poem.
That's a great poem.
That's a poem that was inspired by reading the travelogues of Basho, the Japanese haiku poet.
I have noticed in your work an influence from the Chinese and Japanese writings. Have noticed also a great connection to the ancestry of the earth. You're deeply rooted in ancient ways, and it shows in your poetry. There is a lack of tension and a lack of stress. It's like you've taken yourself out of the middle of the poetry and let it just be and let it just flow. But if you can find that poem,
yes,
with that wonderful last line.
It's called Reading Basho's Travel Sketches. And Basho was a Zen monk as mm-hmm. well as a haiku poet. And so a lot of the spirit of what I was talking about previously, I absorbed from reading his haiku and his travel sketches. But the travel sketches are so unpretentious. I was just moved by his ability, again, just to be present to whatever was happening to him. So this is Reading Basho's Travel Sketches. Although it's summer, I drink hot tea to stay awake long enough to finish reading Basho's travel sketches. Wherever he goes, he is moved by his experience of things, visits to ruined temples, sleeping in barns, sharing a room innocently with two prostitutes. Even his sadness at missing the full moon at Kashima Shrine, or falling off his horse, crossing support yourself on a stick pass. How his warm eyes must have brightened finally under the brim of his worn-out cypress hat as he beheld at last the wild cherry blossoms of Yoshino. Eternity, he always seems to be saying, is just being somewhere with all of your heart.
Mm. And that is what eternity is.
Yeah,
it may be
so.
In a second, it may be in a moment, but just to be there with all of your heart.
Yeah, and that's difficult, actually. If you look at your day-to-day state of mind, if you added it all up, you would probably come out much more, with a much greater amount of time spent resisting being where you are.
Mm.
Rather than being willing to be where you are. But
the downside of that is that you have not been going out knocking people over the head with an axe to promote yourself, because all of your poetry is a wonderful sense of a belief in the thing itself, that the poem will rise like cream to the top, and that it is antithetical for me to think of you going out and knocking on doors. And yet at the same time, because of that, we don't have a book of yours yet, which we will. I know this is the year. I feel it. This is the year.
It could be.
But I wouldn't have sacrificed one of these magnificent poems for you to be a different way.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, one of the reasons why I was always taken with Chinese poetry and Japanese poetry, and haiku especially, I suddenly realized after a couple of years of reading Chinese poetry and Japanese poetry that when you read those poems, you feel as if you're reading a poem that was never meant to be published. It was written in some private, personal kind of celebration or praise or expression. In the privacy of the person's own home, you know. It's not ostentatious. It's not meant to, you know, impress or make a lot of noise. It's written in obscurity. That's the feeling that you get when you read Chinese poetry.
But really, don't you know when you're hitting pay dirt is when you're saying something which is so secret and so damp inside of you that all of a sudden it is the most universal thing?
Well,
the farther down, the farther out. Joe Salerno is our guest. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and tonight is a very, what is the word? What's a descriptive, an adjective for celebratory? Celebratory, that's the adjective.
That sounds like
it. It is a celebratory occasion. Read us some more, Joe.
I'll read another poem that comes out of this same period. This poem tries to deal a little bit with the tension of rather than with transcendence. I think it deals more with the tension. It's a poem called Shadows. And again, it deals with myself as a father with children. It's related to the Only Here poem. Shadows. Suddenly in my life, there are two children. I walk out from a house of tears and fevers. In the cool night, I wipe my mouth with my sleeve as if I had just taken a huge year-long gulp of life. The moonlight in my own backyard. The moonlight in my own backyard. And so clearly on the wall of the house, the shadow of the tree cast in the autumn silence. This is the world the Chinese worship, where the shadow is more real than its object. The Buddhists' dreamy world of the unreal real. I watch my own shadow lean out across the cold grass. One cricket squeaks faintly in the autumn dark like the last tiny wheel of summer running down. On the lit shade of the children's bedroom, I see the silhouette of my wife lifting one of the children, the faint crying reaching me through the closed window. I pause a moment before going inside. The real or the unreal? Or is there a third choice? Closing the door behind me, I plunge back in. Outside, the moon goes on, throwing its light down with such immaculate intensity. That might be a little bit of an obscure poem. I don't know. There's a lot of...
It captures you very well, because if you read the manuscript all of a piece, what touched me very much was, here is this New Jersey poet who lives in the real world, as you say, in his lawn chair with his hot sake, who might very easily be on top of a mountain in Japan for the way he's perceiving the world, whether you're counting weeds in the garden or sitting in the freezing night in your lawn chair, that you have made the universe what you wanted it to be, because Basho didn't have to deal with North Caldwell, New Jersey.
Well, you know, the whole secret of Zen, I guess you could say, is that your life and your circumstances offer you everything that you need for a complete life,
and
spiritually, aesthetically. You don't have to go to the mountaintop.
Can you say that one more time? Because if everyone will just listen to that, they don't have to hear the radio anymore this year.
My understanding, anyway, of the secret of Zen is that your life, no matter what it is, offers you everything that you need for a complete life. And you don't have to go to exotic places or searching on long journeys.
You can
if you want to.
Thank you for that. This is one of the only times I can remember that I was afraid we wouldn't get to read all these poems. And I'm already jettisoned your planned reading, I'm sure. But go ahead with what you were going to do, and then I do have a couple of favorites.
Okay. Well, I just was going to read a very short poem, being that we were on the topic of Zen. And I was very happy to have it published in a little magazine. It's a poem called Every Minute Zen. And Every Minute Zen comes from a story about a young Zen monk who goes to visit his master, and it's a rainy day, and he's got his umbrella, and the master opens the door to let him in, and the monk closes his umbrella and puts it down, and they go in and they have this very long session. And at the end of the session, this was kind of like his PhD oral exam, you know, to see if he was enlightened. And at the end of this very long conversation, the master says to him, "By the way, which side of the door did you leave your umbrella?" And the student thought, he says, "I don't know." So the master said, "Well, back to the monastery for another 5 years."
To notice everything, yeah.
Anyway, that's where the title comes from. The poem itself doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just a kind of a little homespun. The poem is just a little homespun Zen, I guess.
And the title again?
Every Minute Zen. Moment to moment, our attention should be at least the same as when we approach an angry hornet that's gotten into the house, and we move slowly towards it with a rolled up magazine, hardly breathing, giving ourselves just this one chance. So, of course, I don't know if Zenists would appreciate killing wasps or hornets, you know, but you know, the idea that we should approach each moment with that kind of concentration, and realize that every moment is one chance.
And the miracle is that it makes us less tired, not more.
Exactly. Takes a lot of the tension out.
Joe Salerno is our poet tonight in every way.
Here's a funny poem. I think this will be the last one. I read this because my kids found this poem, and I'll tell you what their reaction was after I read the poem. The poem is called No Wife, No Kids, No Work. It's about just waking up and being in the house alone after all these tumultuous years of not having a moment, feeling like you haven't had a moment to yourself. You know? I wake alone and throw my rested arms across the bed. Not a sound in the house. The floor is still asleep, dreaming it is the ceiling. Opening and closing my eyes, I float for a long time on the sea of late sunlight, basking like a turtle in the noon warmth. Later, wearing slippers and a frayed blue robe, I cook my breakfast. In the sunlit, empty kitchen, I feel like dancing to the great silence, with a fork in one hand and a cup of fragrant tea in the other. Restored to a separate life, I stand at the stove and watch as the eggs fry wildly in the noisy butter. So there was a copy of this poem lying around, and my oldest son and daughter found it. And they came up and they said, "You were happy because we weren't here?" So I said, well, you know.
Tell them about metaphor.
But you know, I thought it was a cute reaction.
It's interesting because I'm watching everything that ever went into you. And I'm watching in that poem, who can say I'm not the happy genius of my own household?
Well, yes, you hit on it.
William Carlos Williams,
exactly.
Who is a great love of your life. And also I get a little Robert Bly in tone.
Yes,
not in imitation at all, but in tone. But I do... That is a wonderful line, isn't it? Who can say I am not the happy genius of my own household?
I've always loved that poem. I've always wanted to write something that came close to that kind of, you know, quiet celebration, you know.
He came home from I think the poem's Ballet Russe.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you are about to, I think you're about to do some more work on William Carlos Williams. You worked in Paterson, New Jersey.
Yes.
You lived there.
As a teenager, I... worked in some garment factories in Paterson for the summer.
And you're all of a sudden rediscovering?
Well, my dissertation on Charles Olson, of course, brought me right back to William Carlos Williams, who was really, if anyone, was Charles Olson's precursor.
Right.
You might say, would be William Carlos Williams and Ezra Pound. So I did do a lot of research and reading of William Carlos Williams while I was preparing for my dissertation on Charles Olson. And I have to admit, I've always been attracted to that notion of, you know, the local, you know, that somehow poetry ought to come out of the place and the streets and the experiences of your own life rather than, you know, from exotic myths or references to classical times. Not that those things aren't appropriate, but somehow the energy that moves you to write poetry ought to be from the commonplace everyday experiences that you know, that we all have.
Another influence in your life was Robert Hayden.
Yes, Robert Hayden.
Who was here at the Library of Congress in 79.
Right, right.
And what did you say you got from him?
Robert was probably the most spiritual person I'd ever met. His poetry was so lush and physical, and yet it was also spiritual, and he was spiritual, and he was so gentle and kind. I think as a poet, what he taught me just through his example was to be true to your own vision, to be, to follow your own nature. He was criticized a lot during the tumultuous 70s.
Being a black poet.
Being a black poet, writing in a kind of high style. Wallace Stevens was Robert Hayden's favorite poet, one of his favorite poets. But of course, he never sold out any of those things that he was accused of having sold out. And he would never sell himself out as an artist, as a poet. And so it was very tough for him. I was with him on the University of Michigan campus, which was a very active campus.
Yes.
And he took a lot of beatings. I can remember having little conversations with him in his office. And
he was beyond nationalism.
Yes. He was beyond being narrow in any regard. He was just a universal person, and he just couldn't be otherwise.
Well, I must say that I see the integrity of those ideas unconsciously in your work, because if you set about to do that, you couldn't.
Right.
Joe Salerno is his name, Grace Cavalieri is my name, and he's going to carry us further.
Here's another little, somewhat humorous poem, I guess. get into fights. We have these domestic squabbles when we're married. And this is a poem I wrote actually when I was living in Ann Arbor. Donald Hall always thought it was funny. He loved the last line. Anyway, it's called In the Silence After Fighting. I sit in the kitchen drinking.
I'm rather phobic about getting in places I'm afraid I can't get out. And I thought that of your poem, because I thought if I'm going to be trapped here, the idea is to want to be trapped, to give up the fear that that would be a bad thing to do. And I think, you know, there can be far worse recommendations than a poem that gives you something to live by.
Well, you know, that poem came out of a period of my life when I was struggling with my dissertation. Not that it was about that, but I was in a period of intense psychological struggle. I was in therapy. I was not happy with my creative work. You suddenly realize you go through life with a sense of something, you don't even know what, but something has to happen. You're struggling for something, you know? Really, if we just give up and just let it happen, then it's really much more interesting.
I think that that's the only reason we're here, to surrender. So why don't we do it early?
That's right.
And enjoy the rest of it. How did you, harking back to the previous poem, where did you get the line? How did it come to you? As if it had been lost for a long time.
Well, I can't...
Is that something that was written on your desk?
No, I'm pretty sure that was something. That poem actually began with the image of the eye opening. It was funny. I actually, not that it's very interesting, but I had had a dream that I was lying in bed next to my wife, and I just saw her eye open. It was such a strange, it was such a commonplace image, and I was, why would I dream about that? But there was something very engaging to me about a person sleeping, and then their eye opens, and they're looking right at you as soon as they awake, you know. So the poem was kind of written backwards. I wanted to get to that last line.
That is very interesting.
And the poem really, it moved me through the experience of coming home.
Coming home within yourself, yes.
Marriage isn't, you were saying before, nobody gets married anymore. But I think it's very hard to come home, again, without having the relationship of home, wife or husband or someone that you're committed to. Commitment is what makes it home, you know? And so I think the image of the husband's hand kind of
touching her hair. And something which has been lost then is something found.
Right. The speaker in the poem is presented a little bit as being kind of, bitter with failure and fatigue.
Mm.
Those words, one person once thought they were maybe a little too strong. But it's that feeling, that you can let go of all of this gunk and just, be at rest, be at peace, come home. So that's where the line, that's where the line came from, was from that feeling of coming home.
Please continue for us. The program is The Poet and the Poem. Joe Salerno is our poet. I am Grace Cavalieri.
This is a poem called At the End of Day. When the sun deepens at the edge of the sky and evening takes down the houses. when the world, under so many shadows, tips a little nearer to its vanishing. And the car I drive, battered with 10 years traveling, parked in the long light, sweetens inside with tobacco and spilled beer. I walk out in a coat woven from the clear voice of my wife, and standing, feel the pulse of my life shut down, and lift a black flower, the shadow of a single tree, and hold it until everything I have had to touch to stay alive takes its unfinished place. This next poem is called Weeds. You know, you were saying before about my poetry seeming to be rooted in the earth. I do like to think of myself as a nature poet. Of course, I'm surrounded with the more diminutive aspects of nature, living, you know, in a kind of a suburban type of environment. I don't have majestic mountains. I don't have breathtaking landscapes like you do out west. But I do have a lot of weeds. And this poem just came out of, I spent one summer just trying to identify weeds. And what I became very taken with was the very humble names that these weeds have. And there just seemed to be a quality to weeds that is often overlooked, which is exactly their humbleness and their unpretentiousness. Weeds. Horseweed, quack grass, creeping jenny, goosefoot, beggar's lice, bachelor's buttons. These days it seems I have more interest in the names of weeds than in the breasts of women. Their homely titles remind me of the early Chan master Shu Lao, whose name also means a small dirty pool of rainwater along the road. Ribwort, pigweed, fleabane. With my children trailing behind me, I wander the yard and beyond, spending the afternoon searching out the names of these ragged little monks. By evening, I put down my pocket guide to weeds and wait on the porch for darkness. Suddenly, a little poem comes to me out of nowhere, and I write it down on the front page of the book. In the poverty of a single weed, the solitude of a thousand mountains. One of the things I really liked about, this is where little pieces of information that you just kind of pick up along the way, suddenly you see the perfect place to put it in a poem, which was I had been reading a book about Zen, different Zen teachers in China. A Chan master is simply, the Chan is the Chinese word for Zen. But his name in Chinese meant both his name and also it meant a small dirty pool of rainwater along the road. And what a wonderful expression of that Zen humbleness, you know, for a Zen master to have a name that just means a pool of rainwater along the road.
Also, though, the specificity of language in that poem, the naming of things, which is the origin of poetry, and how much I understand what Virginia Woolf said, language is the stays and the props of life. And so you've reached down, and by naming these tiny, insignificant growths, are reinforcing what poetry is again and again. Seeing language not as a boundary.
Well, they're great little names, aren't they? I mean, quack grass, horseweed, goosefoot. Beggar's lice.
What does that look like?
Well, I'm sure you've seen it, because if you've ever walked through a meadow as a kid, you would get these little burrs, these little forked burrs.
That's it?
Stuck in your sweater or your pants. Not the big round ones. They're just like a little fork,
oh.
And they stick there. And I guess they look They call them beggar's lice because the hobos probably would sleep in the sleep in the fields, and they'd have these things.
I have so far to go spiritually. I still like cyclamen and the real, flowers. I still have so far to go.
Well,
but Joe Salerno is taking us along with him.
Here's a short poem called Riker's Hill Near the Abandoned Radar Tower. Topped with snow, the winter weed is sending out a signal no one is hearing. And this is a place, Riker's Hill, near where I live, and there is actually the whole area is an abandoned Nike missile base. And there's this abandoned radar tower, just old, rusty, big, old radar tower. And I was there with my kids because there's also a dinosaur park there. And I just saw these weeds, standing next to the radar. I don't know if that comes through, but in reality, I was thinking of the Queen Anne's lace in winter. It kind of makes a little, kind of looks like a little, even in summer, it looks kind of like a radar, the round radar
disc.
And so here it was, just sitting there quietly being ignored by the whole world, and it just seems such an interesting contrast with the radar tower in back of it. The next poem is called The Bull God, and I won't say, you can ask me some questions, but it's a little bit of perhaps a strange poem. The Bull God. The bull god moves from sunlight into shade, following the drool of his snout to what he needs. Day after day, the rhythm of his blood consumes him, his enormous body a gentle blue desire. He stands for hours in the August sun, flies weaving a dark crown for his massive head, as he waits for the next flutter of delight to stir the heavy neurons of his brain and start again the oblivious lumbering from pleasure to pleasure. The long, slow nerve of his body touched by the scent of bulrushes and black mud. And rubbing against the half-rotted post of a fence the coarse hide of his ponderous belly, he walks slowly away into the insect-singing heat, his great balls swaying behind him like heavy stones, his ancient, swaggering cock as tense with seed as a milkweed pod about to burst with the next touch of the wind.
That is unlike the others, and yet it's like it. But it's the other side, it's the physicalness of us.
Right. It's exactly right.
But how did you get that image?
Well, it's funny. I really don't know that much about bulls. I've not really seen that many bulls. I've seen pictures and not seen them on television, I guess. But one night I had this image, I don't remember exactly why, but I was thinking of a bull, and I was also, I had been at the time thinking that the universe must evolve based on pleasure. It just seemed to me that the universe couldn't have evolved into anything if it wasn't pleasurable to evolve. I mean, there may be conflict, there may be whatever, but pleasure must somehow be the secret motivating factor of creation.
Not instruction.
And I began thinking how we human beings have such a problem with pleasure. We either pleasureize ourselves to death, or we are so afraid of pleasure that we go to the opposite extreme, become ascetic and become sour and dour, and yet animals seem to have this perfect balance. They follow the pleasures that their physical manifestation gives them, but they're not driven to excess, they're not driven to undisciplined, you know, pleasurizing of themselves.
My cats do not overeat.
Right, right, exactly. And I began to see this bull as a kind of a symbol. That's why I call him the bull god.
Wow.
He's kind of the god of the physical realm. He's totally motivated by the physical realm, by pleasure, which is a good thing. So you say that, totally motivated by pleasure, and immediately you sound like a pagan or an Epicurean or someone who's somehow not moral. And of course, they drool, and they're not, bulls aren't always very noble looking at close up. From far away they are, but from close up they've got flies around them and they've got drool hanging from their mouth, you know. But there's a gentleness, there's a at-homeness, there's a peace with their own physical realm. And that's really what I was trying to, in the poem, just kind of create a symbol that would say, you know, the physical world is a delightful place. It's a pleasurable place. It has to be in order for it to continue to go on. I mean, nothing could evolve if it was in a constant state of unpleasure or displeasure. That's why there's a line towards the end of the poem that he rubs his hide up against a half-rotted fence. You see, he's fenced in. But he could crash through that fence if he wanted to, but he's so content, you see, to just be in that realm. He doesn't need the discipline of a fence, you know, which that's a little bit of a poeticism. And he's fertile, you know, the bull as a symbol of fertility. I mean, that's an old symbol. But really what I wanted to get was I wanted to communicate the massive physicalness of the bull and create an image that would be moving to people, that would make them feel their own physicalness. Because we're sometimes so out of touch with it because we live so much in our heads, in our mind, that we forget a lot of times that we have a body, you know.
That's good. That's good. Especially in the age of technology where we are losing parts of ourselves.
All the
time. Every moment. And that's why the bull god.
That's why he's a god.
What is holy in us is ourselves, our humanity, our animism, maybe.
Exactly. I mean, you know, one of the things that really has me bothered these days is I used to think that the economic system or capitalism was the big